not sure we're that desperate just yet.
No, we don't want. You're right. We don't want to get that desperate. I assure you.
But we are recording at this point, so we want to welcome the audience to getting close to the end of season 7 here of Mentioned in Dispatches. As we've noted a couple of times, we've completely given up on the numbering on these things. I think we're on episode 12, but we released a couple of these out of order anyway. So even if we are calling this episode 12, there's nothing saying it's the 12th one we're going to release. So we'll sort of see what we end up with. As we are doing this, we are wrapping up Thanksgiving here in the U.S., and so who was available and not in a food coma is sort of tonight's guest list, but it's the Mikes. It is our buddy OJ's dad. Mike, how are you doing?
I'm good tonight.
There he is. And I'm here. And then BB Mike is also here. How are we doing?
So clearly, we're both mics are still in food comas. Sorry.
Yeah.
So we're here, but we're exhausted. But yeah, we're here.
We've cracked the code over the last couple of years on how to survive Thanksgiving, and that is get the turkey from somewhere else. Like, fix all your own stuff, and that's fine. Go get the turkey from, say, have somebody else do the turkey for you. The last couple of years, we've gotten ours from City Barbecue, and we've gotten a smoked turkey from them, and it's been phenomenal. And it's way better than anything we've ever been able to do on our own for the last 20-odd years, and it just reduces the headache level so much. It's incredible. I suspect that is our plan going forward. So, BB Mike, eventful holiday weekend or pretty mellow and calm?
I'd have to say pretty mellow. I mean, it was more yard work than anything else for me this weekend. So,
yard work? You live on a river. How much yard?
Yeah, well, there's trees around that river and they drop leaves at an astronomical rate.
Yeah, okay. Fair enough. Hey, OJ's dad, calm weekend or full house of insanity?
Thursday, we went to wife's family, and so that was a packed house. But since then, pretty calm.
Excellent, excellent, very good. Son was home from college for us, but still mostly calm, more calm than not, so that was good. Wasn't crazy enough to try and get out anywhere on Friday, although it did have to make a run to the grocery store. But other than that, wasn't crazy enough to go anywhere on Friday. Saturday, for Small Business Saturday, dropped a couple bucks at the local game store here, met up with one of the other Dragoons who happened to be near town, so he drove into town and we hung out for a bit, and so it was a pretty good time for a fairly mellow weekend here. So for tonight, just again, nothing specifically topical in terms of what's going on the calendar at the moment, but something that I thought might be fun to discuss is a little bit of our wargaming evolution as wargamers ourselves. Where did you start? What got you into wargaming as a starting point? And what were the first things that you were playing? And how has your taste evolved? How has your interest evolved? How much of that is just things that you've changed interest in? How much of that might have been driven by availability of things to play or folks to play with or things that you've been exposed to over the years? And let's just talk a little bit about where we started and how we got to where we are today. And with that as a preamble, BB Mike, talk to us, man. I know you're a bit of a sci-fi geek as a part of all of this. Which came first, Star Trek or pushing counters around?
Oh, Star Trek. I think I mentioned this before. Definitely Star Trek. It was Starfleet Battles was the first what I consider war game that I played. And that was back in 79. That was, yeah.
Wow.
And that kind of defined that pretty much it was it for me for wargaming for quite some time, quite a few years. Starfleet Battles. Yeah, that's where it started.
Yeah, you eased into it, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah, right.
Yeah, I know, and let's make calculus fun. We'll put counters on that.
That's also where I first learned about house ruling and making house rules to make things easier. So yeah. So yeah, for me, mainly it was Starfleet Battles, and I was more into role playing games at the time. So I was pretty much stuck in that phase for many years. And I want to say I played a couple of other maybe war games with people, like Ogre, I think comes to mind. I played a few games of that. But yeah, beyond that, Starfleet Battles and Federation Space to go along with it, which was the Empire version of Starfleet Battles.
I think we are all of a generation at which the role-playing wargaming divide was not nearly as wide as it is today, and where folks kind of moved seamlessly between the two.
Yeah.
I think we all started gaming at an era when that was more true than not. So,
yeah, you know, and I look back at that time and I remember going into the local hobby shop to look for whatever. And I would walk by these tables of war games. And, you know, I would just look at them and just keep on walking. But now I'm wondering, what the hell did I walk past that, you know, if I could go back in time, then I would grab young Mike by his scruff of his neck and say, look at these. What are you doing? Because, you know, I've loved history since day one. And how I didn't get into wargaming at that age, I'll never know.
Yeah, no kidding. Do you remember what the first actual war game was that you played that wasn't Starfleet Battles, the first like historical based something?
Oh my gosh, that's a good question. I don't really know. I haven't really thought about that. Huh. Give me some time to think on that when they come back around to it, I guess.
Oh boy.
It was probably, knowing me, it was probably a Civil War game.
Yeah. But might be a safe bet, knowing you.
Probably a safe bet, and then a Pacific game if it weren't a Civil War game, right?
Yeah, no kidding. OJ's dad, where did you get your start? What was your intro to the wargaming hobby?
Well, back in fifth grade, so this would have been about, 79, me and another guy got bored in class one day, took out a sheet of paper, and we just started making these dots on the paper. One of us was Union, one of us was the Confederates. We had no rules or anything, and we just started drawing lines, killing each other's dots. So that was probably my first war game. No idea what we were doing. Kind of fell out of it when we moved to England and got into RPGs at that point, and then came back in about 84, 85, started getting into some tabletop wargaming at that point.
Do you remember what the first published tabletop war game was that you played?
I do not remember what the actual first one was.
Yeah.
Looking at things on my shelf right now, I have SPI's World at War, European Theater. I have Starfleet Battles, Gulf Strike, Harpoon, and I got some of the Europa modules. So okay. Gulf Strike may have been probably one of my first ones.
Okay.
I had a guess.
Cool. Yeah,
the Assault. I got Assault also from GDW. That may have been one of my first ones also.
I definitely remember that one from the mid-80s, picking that up at the exchange, and a bunch of us sort of trying to figure out how to play it. Probably failing miserably, knowing us.
Yep. the Third World War series, me and another kid in my high school, we played that song. Mostly got my games from Who's Hobby in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Okay. So are they still there, just out of curiosity?
I think so. I think I looked them up a couple years ago. What they sell now, I have no idea. It was kind of like a catch-all hobby store.
Yeah. It'd be cool if they were still there, still doing their thing. So, that's very cool. For me, wargaming started kind of sitting on my dad's lap back in the mid-70s. I'm a few years younger than you guys, not atrociously. It's not like I'm Command 10 or something, you know, but I can remember sort of pushing counters around with my dad some on a couple of war games that he had some friends over playing back in the mid 70s when we were stationed in Germany. And when we got back to the States, there were a few more war games that we poked around with here and there. And I don't think like Third Reich was the first one that I ever pushed counters around with my dad. Look, I was, you know, again, I was young, elementary school age, so it was just cool that I was doing something there with my dad, and that was fun. But I remember Third Reich, but I don't think it was the first one I ever did. He had a lot of friends that had some games that they'd bring over to play, so we didn't own a ton ourselves. And then in the late 70s, early 80s, when we had moved back to the U.S., we picked up a couple of games of our own here and there. And I remember the first one my dad ever bought me. I insisted on my dad buying it for me because I was an idiot and I didn't know any better. And that was Red Star, White Star from SPI. That was the first one that was my game that wasn't something my dad was letting me use. Horribly complicated game to give a nine-year-old. Like, there's no nine-year-old on the planet that needs to be trying to play Red Star, White Star. But I was a moron because I was only nine. And so some friends of mine and I house ruled the entire thing to try and figure out what we were doing. And later my dad ended up giving it to a friend of his, which was probably the smart move. I did not need a game of that complexity. But later picked up a variety of the classic Avalon Hill titles like Squad Leader and Panzer Leader and Arab-Israeli Wars and whatever. Much like you guys, in the early 80s, drifted more towards role-playing games than war games. But I, you know, again, bounced pretty seamlessly between the two for a long time, where the same folks that I was playing squad leader with were the same folks I was in a D&D campaign with. And the same people that we were trying to puzzle our way through how to play Assault were the same people that we'd also pull out a copy of Star Frontiers and play some sci-fi space RPG gaming. So it was, for us, it was hobby gaming as a whole, not any one particular thing. Mike, you mentioned picking up a bunch of your games at the place in South Dakota. For me, there was a toy store in the Del Monte Mall in Monterey, California, where I had picked up some of my early role-playing stuff and a couple of war games here and there. When I moved back to California 15 years later, 12 years later, somewhere around there, that store was still there and was more games than toys at that point. And it was still there as of 2003 or so. One of our trips back there, my wife's family is still there. And it was still there. And then somewhere between that and one of our later trips, they relocated. So as far as I know, they're still in Monterey as a game store. They're just in a different place. So 40-ish years later at this point, they're still going, which I think is kind of cool. That's kind of neat.
I just looked up Who's Hobby is still in Rapid City. It's been there since 1950.
Wow.
That's amazing.
They don't have much. Now, their website is pretty bare bones. Don't see any games listed on, shown on there. It looks like it's more trains, RC, cars, kites, planes, that type of thing.
Yeah. You know, we've got a store like that here in town that I met up with one of the Dragoons over there to push some war games around because they've got a couple of game tables in there. They are primarily an RC hobby place like that. Tons of airplanes and trains and things. But they've got a large chunk of one end of the store set aside for wargaming, and almost all of it is minis wargaming. So tons of stuff from Bolt Action and Flames of War and Team Yankee, as well as some of the fantasy stuff like the Privateer Press Iron Kingdom stuff and Age of Sigmar Warhammer stuff, a variety of those things. But it's they've got a pretty significant chunk of minis wargaming in a store that is primarily RC hobbies like the one you're talking about. So BB Mike, you remember where you were picking your stuff up way back when?
Yep, it was a little place called Cordova Toy and Hobby in Cordova Mall in Pensacola, Florida. And like Mike was saying, it was one of those little hobby shops that sold everything, models, role-playing games, you name it, they had it. And that's where I was getting stuff from.
Yeah.
And I think, I mentioned earlier that, walking by those tables and not really getting into wargaming at that time. And I was just starting high school at the time. And I think one of the reasons why I didn't get into wargaming, board gaming so much is because that's when this little thing called the Commodore 64 came out. And that's where all of my attention was. And, I certainly played digital versions of war games and board games on that thing. Cause there was, I can't remember how many Commodore 64 games I actually had. So that was kind of a distraction from the actual board games back then. And that was the new thing in town.
the slightly new thing. So what were you playing on the C64? Were you playing Bard's Tale like everybody else? Bard's Tale and Lode Runner?
Yeah, all of those games. I mean, any popular game that was on the Commodore 64, I was playing. And then the ones that weren't so popular, like the space station simulations, and there were a couple of Civil War games for that as well. And in fact, I think there were a lot of war games on the Commodore 64, now that I think about it. I know there was, D-Day ones, there was Revolutionary War ones. It was just, that was the big thing. And that was like, it ended up being a huge thing, right? So,
Yeah. Well, you'd have to go back probably looking around to see what was there back then. I imagine half our audience is busy yelling titles at their podcast listener of listening tool of choice to try and figure out, hey, don't forget about this game.
Probably my first true war game was on an Atari computer in the early 80s. It was an Eastern Front game.
Yeah.
Don't ask me the title of it. I have no idea.
Well, I can remember the Intellivision having sea battles and something else, like a sea war, Navy war, something or other, that they had on the Intellivision. But we had, of course, an Atari 2600, which means I couldn't play. And so we had the basic combat cartridge that came with the 2600s. We were almost all tabletop gaming. The video gaming stuff was a it was one of those things you begrudgingly did if it happened to be raining outside. But otherwise, we were off playing Wargame stuff like crazy. And it happened that a friend of mine that lived right around the corner on the post back at Fort Ordon, Monterey, back when Fort Ordon still existed, that his dad was a really big war game player and collector. And so there were a handful of the kids, or about a half a dozen of us, that hung out at their house a lot because we had a lot of war games that we could play there to work our way through. Some Napoleonic games, a lot of us gravitated towards some of the fantasy sci-fi kind of stuff like Starship Troopers. I remember us playing a bunch. The TSR micro game for Revolt on Antares, we played some. There were a variety of those, the fantasy sci-fi ones. Mike, like you'd mentioned, starting with Starfleet Battles, you know, the sci-fi things were the ones that caught us because we're all Star Wars nerds and these things have laser beams. And so, you know, when you've got a bunch of fourth graders that are watching movies with laser beams, we want to go play with laser beams. And so we're getting the sci-fi war games much more than Napoleonics or, you know, the American Revolution kind of stuff. Those just weren't as of greater interest for us compared to spaceships and laser beams.
Yeah, for me, it wasn't so much my personal interest. It was just lack of finding other people to share those interests with.
Yes.
So, you know, when you're in high school, you know, all your friends are playing Dungeons and Dragons or Traveler or, you know, one of the guys even made up his own Traveler type game system. You know, it's then kind of hard sometimes to find direction and proceed.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially for some, you and I both grew up in military families moving around a bunch.
Yep.
Yeah. And so you had zero control over who you had available to play with, given that, you know, everybody's rotating in and out every 6 months. And so you've got different people around all the time. That was one of the first things I would do whenever we moved to a new base. The first thing I did was go find the gamers. Where are the gamers? Because those were the folks I was interested in hanging out with. And they were the ones that had the stuff I wanted to be able to play. So
yeah,
that's what I went to go find.
Yeah. Well, and you know, and it's high school, right? You know, my dad's last duty assignment, we got there at the start of my, you know, right before I started sophomore year, you know. So, and granted, most of us were all in the same boat, but at the same time, I'm kind of looking at this as like, I'm going to be here 3 years, and after that, I'll probably never see any of these people again. You know, you're going through all the high school stuff. We just come back from England in 84, you know. It was just kind of mind-boggling in a lot of ways.
Yeah. It's weird because my last years of high school were the 2 years that I was actually in the same place for a bit. And while I had a bunch of game purchasing that happened those 2 years, there was remarkably little game playing because there were so few gamers at that particular school that I had friends that when we from other duty stations where we had lived before, that when we got a chance to get together and hang out, we would pull stuff out and play, usually role playing stuff, because those need a lot less footprint to set up. You know, four people can sit around a living room and just have a character sheet in their lap and be able to play a role-playing game that you don't need a lot of setup like you do for a tabletop war game. That was usually a lot easier. So I ended up buying a lot of stuff during those 2 years, but I didn't end up playing nearly as much as I would have liked to. That's when I bought a lot of my Space 1889 and a lot of my TWRPS stuff from Game Science. And a lot of my Battletech stuff that I'd started buying some of that stuff in Europe and then bought more once we got back to the States. But I didn't play nearly as much as I purchased, which kind of sounds like today, honestly.
I was going to say, yeah, that sounds familiar.
But some things don't change that much. I get it. But I didn't have a great population to play with there, which was unfortunate. It's just sort of how it worked out. So, from where you started with your original interest to where you are today, BB Mike, started with Starfleet Battles. I know you'd still love to be playing you some Starfleet Battles if you could find some people crazy enough to do it. But at what point did you start evolving into, hey, those muskets are kind of cool, and getting a greater interest in that period? And how much has that waxed or waned over your time as a war gamer?
Well, I mean, so like I said, this, you know, once the computer came along and I started with the VIC-20, went to the Commodore 64, and then all, you know, since then I've had a computer ever since, you know, who hasn't, I guess. So I think what happened was I spent most of my time playing the war games on computers, PCs, you know, the old DOS 3.0 or whatever. And sticking the disks in the drive and loading them up. I stayed on computers up through probably almost the mid, maybe 2005 or somewhere in that time frame, where I stumbled on one of the war game websites, and I don't remember which one it was. It wasn't the one we all used to hang out before this one. It was something before that even. It was actually the computer wargaming that led me back to, you know, the physical tabletop board gaming. And so it was kind of this reawakening or first awakening, I guess, of actually, oh yeah, there are war games that are not on the computer. and they've been there for many, 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 many years. And that's kind of where I guess I got back into actually into the actual physical board game hobby, the war game hobby.
So do you remember roughly what year that was ish?
I guess it was, you know, 2005, maybe a little earlier, maybe a little bit later. I can't remember. Maybe okay. If I went back and looked at my old forum names or something on these little websites, okay. I could figure it out.
So the mid aughts.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's not too bad.
So. It's been a while now, but yeah.
Yeah, sounds like it.
And, you know, considering how big my collection is now, it's not huge. It's not like Stuka Joe huge, but it's, yeah, considering how many I have now since then, it's I made up for lost time pretty well.
As Armchair Dragoons continue the seventh season of Mentioned in Dispatches, we need to take a moment to thank those Patreon supporters who pledged at the regimental patron level. So a special thank you to Patrick Mullen, Hethwill Wargames, Steelgrave, Mike Quigley, Staggerwing, Robert, Joseph Knoll, Treb Curry, Kevin Bertram, and Patrick Garrity for their support of Armchair Dragoons and helping us bring you the best wargaming content on the web. You can join our Patreon supporters at patreon.com/armchairdragoons.
OJ's dad, what do you got? When did you start to evolve into where you are today?
Oh, I was like Mike, you know, heavy on the PC side for many, many years, mostly because just never came across anybody locally that had the tabletop interests of any kind. So never went that direction. Started probably buying some tabletop games again about 4 years ago. About 4 years ago or so, probably when I got the first module for the Derwiltkrieg World War One system.
Okay. So I know one of your more recent evolutions has been your heavy participation in Saturday Night Fights, as well as the other nights of the week that our boy Cyrano has been gaming and streaming things. And that has definitely changed what you play, if not necessarily what you purchase.
Yep.
Because you are doing a lot of, let's say you're doing a lot of minis wargaming without having to paint stuff up, right?
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. And that was my first foray into miniatures. So actually have started purchasing some miniature rule sets now. So,
yeah.
But have you purchased any actual miniatures?
That was my next question.
No, I have not.
Yeah. Will you purchase any miniatures?
You know, I would not purchase them to do it on a table. Okay, we'll put it that way. But you know, I guess if I ever came across something that really piqued my interest, you know, more of a display type thing than a gaming piece, then I could possibly buy something. But I'm not looking for anything at the same time. So you know, it'd be more of a what's this?
yeah you know, I mentioned on the forums I had recently come across a copy of Battle Cry, the first edition, and it comes with miniatures, and I was really surprised at just how detailed those figures are, you know. And I thought, these would look really good if they were painted, but it's this whole road I don't really want to go down.
Yeah.
I just don't.
Did OJ's dad, important question though, what scale minis are you planning on playing with?
Whatever Jim sets up on the table. I'm guessing it will never be 12 millimeter.
I guess the beauty of using the digital minis is that you can always create them at 12 millimeter and just multiply by 2.004 or whatever to get them up to, 25 millimeters.
Yeah.
Multiply by 1.12 or whatever you need to get them up to 15 millimeter, huh?
Yep. As long as Jim gets the measurement, the calculations done, the table size right, then we're good to go.
Yeah.
I mean, a tabletop simulator, you don't even have to calculate. It's just you grab the little, you know, the tool on the left-hand side there, grab it and drag it and make it bigger. It's easy.
Au contraire, you absolutely need to calculate when creating the map.
Well, yeah, right. If you're going to create the map, but if you're doing just the figure, you can make that thing any size you want.
When you create the map, you absolutely need to create the map at the appropriate scale.
Well, the figure sizes, though, matter too, Mike, because they are on bases, right? And that all plays into movement. So with rules say you can move three base widths.
I mean, you guys are actually
talking about a difference.
No, you guys are actually talking about playing a game. I'm just talking about making the figures. I mean, you can make them any size you want.
Yes, you are absolutely correct. Yes.
If you put those things on a table, then yeah, you're going to want to probably scale them to something that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's only happened one time.
But it was hilarious.
It was hilarious because we were like, what, almost to the end of the game, we were like an hour and a half into this, and the French are still trying to get to Quatre Bras, and weren't even close to getting there.
Yeah, people aren't even in visual range of each other yet. Yeah, that was – it was good for a laugh.
It's like the end of the Holy Grail when they're running towards the castle.
Yes, very much like that, actually.
That was the example that everybody was using.
A question, though, in all of that, OJ's dad, when after you started playing with Saturday Night Fight stuff, you mentioned you've picked up a couple of copies of some different minis rules, obviously inspired by some of the gaming you've been doing with our Grognard of the Year, Cyrano. How much, if at all, has that changed your interest in periods of warfare or studying particular kinds of, because look, we all know the Gascon is nuts for anything with a short Corsican in it, although he wasn't all that short. Got it. Yeah, a medium-sized Corsican. And so it was that Age of Gunpowder, Napoleonic, American Civil War era of large interest to you before you started playing in Saturday Night Fights, or is that something that, well, that's the game available, so I'm going to play in it, but hey, this is actually kind of interesting. Let me go dig into it a little more.
I really did not follow much on the Napoleonic time frame, so definitely learning a lot more about it here over the last, 3 years or so that we've been playing. And it's kind of like that with just about all the different scenario sets. You know, we've got down into some of the colonial battles down in Africa, a little bit of American War of Independence, you know, so... So I usually try to look up the battles and get a little bit of understanding of them a little bit more, even if it's just looking them up on Wikipedia just to kind of get a glance at it, you know, at least initially.
Yeah, yeah. Because, you know, as I recall, you were kind of nuts for a bunch of the World War One stuff, and that had been a primary area of interest for you. In you know, you mentioned Der Weltkrieg, but some of the other war games that we've talked about over the years that you were really interested in, a lot of those were World War One things.
Yeah.
So how did your interest in World War One come about? Was it a historical thing, or was it, hey, these games look kind of cool, let me grab those and then learn more about the war as I go?
I would say my interest in World War One came first.
Okay.
So, and just kind of, you know, as I started getting back into, you know, as I was doing gaming and start looking at tabletop games again, I threw the question out there of what would be a good operational level World War One game, and our friend Bob there in England throughout the Der Weltkrieg series, and started down that path.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's cool. So BB Mike, with you and your gunpowder and muskets, that love has retained over time from coming back out of the digital world into the tabletop world. In any particular reason that's the era that you just completely gravitate to? Were there digital games in other eras that kind of tempted you some and you just didn't stick with them?
I would play like the Napoleonic stuff sometimes on the computer, but not much. It was mostly Civil War and World War II things. And I've always had an interest in the Pacific theater, even before, you know, gaming. I don't know why, but I've always, whether it was just watching a movie on TV or just reading a book, I've always had an interest in the Pacific theater. I have no explanation why. And always an interest in the American Revolutionary War. You know, I've had a lot of interest in both of those topics. And, you know, I guess one of the, in evolving and playing war games, I've kind of branched outside those, you know, those two main favorite areas of interest. And as I get older, I guess I'm a little more willing to try some of the other eras. And one of the things, like Mike was just talking about, and it's, you know, it's the power of Cyrano and watching his Saturday Night Fights. I picked up a couple of miniatures rule sets, and I've really picked up an interest in Napoleonic warfare that I never had before. So there's some evolution there, I suppose.
It's probably a good thing we don't have him on the podcast tonight, or his head would be too big to fit in his hat.
Well, I mean, he's that good, though, right? If you've ever watched Saturday Night Fights, you need to. And then you might start getting into 12-millimeter miniatures and Napoleonics. Who knows?
Yeah, no kidding. I've played some various Napoleonic miniatures over the years, going back to, again, when I was a kid, and the local war game dad in the neighborhood had a bunch of Napoleonic minis, and so we'd play with some of those. I actually, in the early 80s, when we were living out in Norfolk, there was a place in Norfolk whose name is completely escaping me. I'd have to go look it up, that I had bought a couple of games from and a couple of minis from here and there. When I went back to Norfolk one time back in 2011, 2012 or so, it was still there. I went back and found it, and it was still there. Something like the Little Emperor or something like that. I don't remember exactly what it was called. But one of the things that I'd picked up along the way was a set of 15-millimeter French Napoleonic Old Guard minis, and had based them on popsicle sticks, because that's what I could get my hands on, and actually tried to paint them and did a horrible job because I'm a fifth grader trying to paint 15-millimeter minis. And I don't recommend that. Like, to all you fifth graders out there listening, don't try to paint 15-millimeter Napoleonic minis. I could never get the buttons squared off just right. I'd had some Napoleonic minis over the years, even living in Europe and being able to travel to some of the Napoleonic battlefields. It just didn't catch my interest near as much. And I think one of the reasons for that is I spent a lot of those years as a role-playing nerd. And so when you're doing a lot of role-playing stuff, and it's a lot of dragons and wizards and castles, and you're in Europe where there's a castle around every corner, you're going and checking out the castles and more of the medieval and ancient, you know, all that pre-gunpowder stuff, right? Give me swords and armor and pikes and lances and whatever else. And that was stuff that was much more of interest to me. And so if I was looking at war game stuff that didn't involve a tank, then I was looking more at ancient warfare, because that was the stuff that was more closely tied into the role-playing things that I was doing at the time. And yeah. And that's, you know, you're looking for inspiration wherever you can find it. The history books that I was reading were ancient Greece, ancient Rome, medieval history, again, because that's the stuff that I was mining for ideas for role-playing things that we were doing, far more than any of the war game stuff was. Was there a role-playing game of life in the Napoleonic Wars? Yeah, probably. I didn't know what it was. I wasn't looking for it. So that was an area of less interest to me because of my other gaming interests at the time. So I just, you know, a little different there. OJ's dad, somewhere in all of your gaming time, from way back when to where you are now, is there something from years ago that you were super big into that you're just not even touching anymore, either from lack of interest or lack of people to play with? Just something that you were really big into for a while and has fallen completely by the wayside?
No, I don't know that there's anything I'm big into or that I was big into that I don't get into anymore. Maybe the closest would be some World War II stuff.
Yeah. World War II is just not as much of an interest for you these days.
No. Yeah.
Okay.
So. My three areas that I prefer to look at are post-American Civil War up through World War I, modern stuff, and then sci-fi space.
Yeah. Yeah. So, hey, BB Mike, what about you? Something you were really big into at one point and just not into anymore?
I don't think so. I think everything that I kind of started with, I still game, you know. I've added to it. I haven't really taken anything away. And maybe that's why the collection's getting so big. I don't know.
So there was never some point where medieval warfare was cool and then you just quit doing it.
Well, now there are some, you know, like medieval, there are areas I have yet to get into. So I've never been an ancients person. I don't think I own one game that's ancients. So there are some uncharted territories out there I have yet to explore.
Yeah.
But I think everybody, it seems like most people have only, you know, two or three really big areas they game or eras they game in. Like, I know you like Cold War stuff, Cold War gone hot stuff. Like, are there other areas, other games that you like other than, say, Napoleonics? Or is it you only have...
So Napoleonics, just looking at my looking at the wall of games in here, other than War and Peace, I don't think I have any Napoleonic anythings. And even that War and Peace game is as much a nostalgia thing from where I used to have it as anything else. The Shores of Tripoli is, as the Charlies have informed us, Shores of Tripoli is a Napoleonic era game. So I do have that one. The I have a bunch of different medieval and pre-gunpowder games, some more heavy war game versus some that were sort of the fantasy adjuncts to the fantasy games that were sort of the war game version of the fantasy games, like the X10 module, the Red Arrow Black Shield module that was actually a war game disguised as a D&D module, as a for instance. The Cold War goes hot stuff for me, as much as anything, that's an area of interest because that's what I lived through. You know, that's what I grew up with. We used to always get the games out. First thing we try to do is find our home, you know, find where we were living on the maps, because that was what we were interested in. So for me, it's either pre-gunpowder or today. You know, that's kind of the two areas there.
Yeah.
I've played a lot of World War II stuff over the years just because it's easy to find opponents for World War II games. The challenge that I've had with Napoleonic and American Civil War stuff is many... this is far more true of Civil War stuff than it is of Napoleonics or American War of Independence. To me, there's just not that much left to explore about the Civil War. It's been so done to death, in whether it's been in gaming or in history articles or in whatever pop culture things are going on. It still echoes in U.S. politics today. And it's just not something that I think I'm really going to get that much out of exploring, that I guess the juice isn't worth the squeeze for me. And so if it's American Civil War stuff,
that's where I'm at with Cold War II.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, and I totally get that. And to be fair, I'm probably personally more there with World War II. Also, I'm probably more in line with you. The reason I'm willing to suck up a World War II game is because there are times when I can find opponents for World War II games a lot easier than anything else. And I would rather play no game than a Civil War game personally, but I'd rather play a World War II game than no game. So, plus there's tanks in World War II, right? I got tanks to drive around and blow stuff up, so I'm happy to play with the tank. But the Napoleonic stuff, for me, it's probably been done as much, maybe more, than the American Civil War when you start expanding your parameters beyond just American scholarship into international scholarship. The Napoleonic era has probably been analyzed just as much to death. I don't know enough about contemporary European politics to know how much, if at all, the Napoleonic Wars are still reverberating into today's political environment there. It's not a preferred era for me. But like, you know, Mike, I think you were in the game the other day when unfortunately I had to bail out early because I had to go take care of something with my daughter. But I was happy to sit down and play a Napoleonic game just to have an opportunity to play something.
Right.
I'm far more willing to do that with Napoleonics than I am with Civil War stuff. War stuff doesn't make me.
And I haven't really ever gamed out Civil War real heavily before. So I think two or three times that we've done those using the Altar of Freedom rule set, you know, it's fine. So.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things that I'm always willing to dig into a game for one of those non-traditional eras, if I've got an opponent who is capable and willing of to teach. So for instance, if somebody wanted to sit down and play Pax Baltica from GMT, one of the Levian campaign series from Volko, or a World War One something, or Spanish American War something, Mike, you picked up one of the Russo-Japanese naval war games not long ago. If somebody wants to sit down and teach one of those, I am more than happy to sit down and play. I don't know that I'm going to spend a whole lot of time trying to teach myself how to play them, just because I got other things I'd rather do with my time than try and figure out a set of rules on my own. But I'm more than happy to sit down and play with somebody else who's willing to teach things when it's one of those eras that you don't often
run into a whole lot with. That's one of the reasons I'm hoping that maybe Mike and I get a chance to sit down and play some horse and musket stuff face to face someday, because that's an era that I haven't explored a whole lot. So Mike, when you get a chance to teach some horse and musket, let's get together and play some horse and musket there for a bit.
That's possible. It's an easy system to teach and learn. And it's, and I mentioned this before, there are, you know, when I bought Horse and Musket Dawn of an Era, I bought it. It's way outside my normal, what I would play it, but you pick up an interest in these battles. And like Mike was saying, it's kind of makes you want to go read more about these battles. And I think most of us wargamers are also history, have an interest in history. And it's just, it makes you want to go read about these battles. And it just, of course, that's going to lead to more game purchases, but
No.
This was the horse and musket. This is Horse and Musket from Hollandspiel that you were referring to, correct?
Yes, it is. It's released volume 4, which they're up to just getting up to the Napoleonic era. I think the next, volume 5 will be Napoleonic battles.
Yeah, it's taken a while to get there, but we finally did.
So. We got there.
You know, I'm rotating in place to take a look at some of the stuff on my game shelf. For instance, I've got a copy of Maneuver, and it's a fun game. It's Napoleonic era, but with 8 different armies in the box, you can mix and match stuff for some hypothetical. It's all representative actions anyway. It's abstract, but sort of Napoleonic theme. But like, if you wanted to play the U.S. versus the Ottomans, you could totally do that, because they're all in the box and every country has their own deck of cards they work from. You know, when I first learned to play, I learned to play from the designer. I learned to play before it had ever gone to press. It was still in playtest mode, although the playtesting was pretty well wrapped up and they were busy negotiating with the publisher to get it published, the point of time at which I learned it. And it was a lot of fun. And I bought a copy to help support my friend who was the designer. And I have over the years taught it to a couple of people also. And I enjoy sitting down and playing that one. That's not one that I sat down and figured out myself. It's one that somebody taught me how to play. Same thing, even going Cold War era, though, Dawn's Early Light, I sat down, I had a chance to sit down and play with the designer. So we sat down and learned how to play. And the Dawn's Early Light that I'm referring to is the one designed by Pete Bogdazarian and published by Lock and Load that is Cold War Goes Hot in Europe, not one of the War of 1812 kind of games. It's from the Core Command series. A lot of fun. Bought a copy. Support the designer kind of thing. But it's a game that I've had a lot of fun with over the years and have been able to teach to some other folks. For me, I'm willing to sit down and play lots of things with lots of people if they're willing to teach them, just to sit down and have the social experience playing the game with them.
I would think that if you have the opportunity to have the designer of a game sit down and teach you his game or her game, I at that point, for me, the topic wouldn't matter. Let's do it. let's have some fun, you know. That's pretty impressive.
That's not intended as a humble brag, and I sure hope it didn't come across like that. I just happen to know a couple of folks whose game, like, I knew Jeff before Maneuver was a thing. Now Jeff has turned out to be a he's a really smart dude, has turned out to be a successful game designer with a couple of different things under his belt, not just with Maneuver, but he's the guy that did Thunder Alley. And he's done a couple of other things that GMT have published over the years. And Jeff and Carla have designed a couple of different really cool games. And they're nice people. The reason I ended up with Jeff sitting down teaching that to me is we both belonged to CABS when I lived in Columbus. And so I had a chance to learn a game from a dude who had designed a game. And so I thought, sure, Jeff, show me your game. Let's see. And it was fun. And we had a good time. I happened to have met Pete through some other mutual friends at Origins. And Pete had this design. I said, sure, let's sit down and play. And we had a great time playing the game. And then it ends up getting published. So it wasn't like I was off, you know, trying to, you know, buy a raffle ticket to win a game with Mark Herman or something. You know, it wasn't any of that. Guys I happen to know who had designed a game, and that's just sort of how it evolved. The times I've had a chance to sit down and play with a designer weren't things like that, where it was somebody who was already a known name quantity in the game business. It was people I happen to know who ended up designing a game. So it was
a good reason to go to Origins, right?
It was. 05 was the first Origins I had attended. It was the first one when I was there as an exhibitor back when I, you know, was trying to be a game publisher. And it was a blast. Dude, talk about eye-opening. You know, I mean, you learn a lot at your first convention doing something like that. And we had no idea what we were doing, but we had a good time doing it, trying to figure it out as we went. But yeah, met a lot of people that to me growing up were, you know, the name on the outside of the book, when you're growing up, you're like, wow, that's really cool. That guy got a book published. He must be somebody really important. And then suddenly they're sitting in the audience when you're giving a talk at the Origins War College. You're like, wait a minute, this is backwards. Like, this is weird. You're supposed to be up here and I'm supposed to be in the audience listening to you. So that happened a couple of times. It was weird. Like, I still haven't fully gotten over it. Like, I've got a bad case of imposter syndrome when stuff like that happens. It's like, wait a minute. Like, why are you here listening to me? Yeah, this should be the other way around. It's odd to me still that happens. I mean, it's cool, but it's still weird. So,
I think one of my nightmares is actually going to Origins and as a GM and running a game and having the designer sit down at the table and have him expect me to teach him how to play his game.
I had a friend of mine that was telling me I think it was at Gen Con, it might have been at Dragon Con, I don't remember which, but he was GMing something, or he got roped into filling in for a GM who had something else come up. And it turns out it was he's the GM presenting one of those play with the designer kind of things. And so, look, as the GM, you're really just there to sort of make sure that all the pieces and parts are in the right place and the game flows. Anybody's got any questions, you're the dude looking up the thing in the rule book. But you're there to collect the tickets and make sure nothing goes crazy or anything. And I don't remember exactly who the designer was. Reiner Nietzsche is the one sticking in my head, but I don't remember for sure if it was him. And they're sitting down to play, and the GM kind of sort of looks at the designers like ready to defer to him and, you know, okay, boss, take it away. This is your game. And the guy kind of looks back at the GM. He's like, you're going to have to go over all this again. I don't 100% know how to play this thing. It's because, like, some of those dudes have multiple dozens of game publications to the, you know, of game credits, you know, in their name, and they don't remember how to play them all.
Yeah.
It's a good problem to have, right? It's a weird problem to have. It's kind of a cool problem to have. But that's actually happened a few times, so...
Of course, if they don't remember the rules to their game, though, you might be able to get away with something.
You probably could. you absolutely probably could. You could
argue with the game designer. No, you're wrong. This is the rule.
Yeah, no kidding. So, OJ's dad had a chance to play with the designer on a couple of things yet?
No, never have. No, I take that back. one of our virtual cons that we did, I think I got to do something with one of the designers for... World at War 85.
Oh, so you were in one of the, if you were playing in one of the World at War 85 games through one of our virtual conventions, then you were playing with the guys who are currently the design gurus.
Yeah.
You know, the original design was done by Mark Walker back in 05, 06, 07. But
sure.
since Keith and Devin and those guys have taken it over under the new lock and load regime, they're pretty much the guys that they kind of own the development of that at this point. So, yeah, if you played in any of those World War 85 games, you were playing with those guys,
right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. No, that's cool. And Keith and Devin are good dudes. They have no problem teaching the hell out of those games. So,
yep.
Yeah. Were you in the World War 85 game because it was an actual topic of interest, or just because that's what fit into the schedule for you?
A topic of interest. I got the Kickstarter set. So I just said I hadn't touched it a whole lot, and so yeah, it was a natural interest to jump into that.
Yeah.
All right, and I'll say again, that was a Kickstarter that you didn't even have to have an interest in that era at all, and it was, you just had to buy that because it was so good. I own that set. I still have it. It was amazing what they threw into it.
I own that set, and I was punching the counters one time when we were trying to record a podcast with Jim and Doug and Bob. It was the dumbest thing I'd done in a long time, because trying to go back and edit out the click sounds of me punching counters the entire time absolutely sucked. Punching was way louder in the background than I ever realized, and trying to get rid of the background noise. But
there you go. You could have turned that into a show, as someone's done.
Yeah. Well, no, punching, not clipping.
Okay. Well, maybe that you could still do a show.
Maybe. But now that somebody's got that shtick, I don't need to do it. Like, that's
true.
Yeah.
And if someone does it so good that there's no point in doing it, then yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's kidding. True. So Gary's show has succeeded far beyond his own wildest expectations, and he'll be the first to tell you that. He had no idea it was going to turn into this. So it's, you know, hey, for what it's worth. He's done well with it, and it's a great way to spend some of Monday evening when you can hang out with other wargamers and just have a chat.
So. Absolutely.
Based on the current trajectory of your wargaming evolution, OJ's dad, what do you think some of your next round of purchases are likely to look like? I know you've already got some of your Christmas stuff wrapped up because the wife's already packaged it up for you and everything, but where do you see, based on your current trajectory, some of your next couple of purchases going and some of the next things you're going to be playing?
Probably going down Great War at Sea series.
Okay.
Probably where I'm going to go next.
The World War One Great War at Sea, right?
Yeah, so they have some World War One, but then they also have their alternate history, which is in the time frame of World War Two, but it's again, we know how World War Two kind of worked out, right? BB Mike, you know this a lot better than I, but there's probably very few scenarios that the Japanese were ever going to beat the U.S. in the Pacific, right?
Yeah.
And so having somebody building an alternate environment around something is a lot more interest to me.
Yeah, some of the World War One alternate history that Avalanche has crafted is definitely some interesting stuff. So it's not that they've made interesting design choices, because that makes it sound like, well, they've made interesting design, like they did something wrong. No, the story that they have crafted is an interesting story. Is the best way to say that. I don't want it to sound like I'm being snarky about it at all. I'm absolutely not. It's a fascinating read how they've crafted that alternate history.
Yeah, and let's be clear, they've built a World War II naval system, but then they've taken that and said, okay, what happens if World War I had ended in 1916 and it just kind of restarts up in the 40s, right? So now you're taking their basic World War II setups and you're now adding some new rule sets on, you know, with alternate navies and alternate histories to do something with.
Yeah, yeah. They had actually done that some with their Second World War at Sea series before they ever ported it back into World War One. In the Second World War at Sea series, they first of all, they went and drafted out all the different rainbow plans from the U.S. Navy from pre-World War II and built games around all of them. But they also went back and statted out a lot of the navies that didn't see a lot of World War II action, and in some cases built some scenarios, some hypotheticals to be able to use those guys against each other, which is how you end up with a Brazil versus Chile at the South Pole sort of shooting war going on, or Argentina and Chile. Down in the cone of fire or whatever was they called it.
Yeah, they've got their one of their base games is based off the whole South American a hypothetical South American conflict.
Yeah. And it's been interesting to see how that's evolved. So.
Well, I think the other thing that's piquing my interest right now in Avalanche Press is they seem to be putting out some good material of historical relevance. I haven't dived into it. Mike, did you get the Black Panthers or was that somebody else?
Oh, with the expansion for
Panzer Grenadier.
It's sitting on my bookshelf right over here. Yeah, I sure did.
Okay, I haven't picked that up yet, but I'd be curious just to look at that from just a reference point of view.
Yeah.
You know,
haven't cracked into that one yet. I need to.
We did get a shout out from Dr. Mike, who runs Avalanche Press, over on their ConSim World feed, because after we had published the article about Black Panthers and Avalanche Press getting dropped by a distributor in Tuesday Newsday, several folks over at the Dragoons in those threads had said, you know, screw that distributor, I'm going to buy a copy of Black Panthers and go support Avalanche Press. And apparently every single person who posted in the thread, screw those guys, I'm going to go buy a copy of the game, actually bought a copy of the game, which is really kind of cool. As Mike pointed out, that never happens. People all say, yeah, I'm going to go buy that, support those guys. And then they kind of forget to, or, you know, or realize that there isn't enough in the checking account to cover it or whatever. And like everybody that said they were going to did, which is really kind of neat. I mean, that's great to see folks stepping up like that.
Also, that's not a standalone game. It's an expansion.
It is.
To their base game. So for people to just kind of, because Mike, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know if you have any of the base games. But I think some of those guys are just kind of going out and buying that material to support the material, and you know, So
no, I actually ended up getting the base game to go with it because like, part of the supporting them, part of it is also, you know, how many topics or how many games are out there on this topic? And it's, I think the one thing we've talked about before on these podcasts is let's see some areas that haven't been addressed before in wargaming. Let's, you know, get some new stuff out there on the table. So of course I'm going to encourage a company that comes out with something that's just, you know, brand new and something that just hasn't been done before.
Yeah. Yeah. It's in this case, whether they were buying it to be able to play the game or whether they were buying it just to support the publisher, everybody said, hey, I'm going to go get a copy of that. And then actually did. That's the part that's really cool. You're right, Mike. It is an expansion to an existing thing, and you need to have certain products in order to have all the pieces to play all the scenarios. That said, Avalanche did build a bundle pack that you can get in order to get everything you need in one shot, and then discounted it, which was kind of cool with them.
And I was going to say it was reasonably priced. It was about what you pay for a war game. Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't.
If you're in their store, if you're on their store site and you put in package on the search, it'll show you all the different packages that they have that are discounted.
Yeah, they will. They will. So. BB Mike, based on your most recent evolution of how things are kind of going, and what do you think is coming up next for you trying to for your next round of purchases for the next couple of things you're going to get?
I hope I'm done purchasing. My backlog is quite extensive. I need to start playing more and purchasing a lot less. So I don't know. I think at this point, if I purchase anything, it's going to have to be something that just looks too interesting to pass up. And I say that knowing that, well, that's just about anything that comes out, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know. I'm hoping to play more and purchase less.
I suspect it will be solo play and involve a musket.
Maybe. I don't know. You know, I've got quite a few, some sci-fi 4X stuff I keep wanting to pull out and give a go.
Yeah.
So who knows? Who knows?
Well, get to it already.
I know, right?
Damn. Some more time. Yeah. So I have a stack now. I have even more of a backlog of things that I need to try and get to the table, in part because I've got a stack of some stuff that I bought while it was on sale. I bought a couple of things that are things I'd been wanting to get for a while and just had to kind of wait for the finances to fall in place to get. And then in a couple of cases, I've got stuff that I was just trying to support a smaller publisher to help them out some. So I've got a copy of 1995 from Consim Limited that I got to get to the table at some point. I want to see what I can do. I finally got my copy of Brief Border Wars, which I'd been wanting to get that. Brian always does great design work, and I've been wanting to get that for a while. My T2K Kickstarter finally showed up. When MMP was having their sale recently before Thanksgiving, I picked up Monty's Gamble and King Philip's War. So I've got those in here now. So I've got a variety of things that I need to try and get to the table at some point. As far as what may be coming up on the purchasing, Mike, not unlike you, I'm trying to slow down a little bit, but I think what may be coming up next for some of the purchasing, our podcast with Amabel has got me kind of intrigued by a couple of the solo series that they've got from the ancient world. And so I may end up throwing a couple of those in the shopping cart before too long and seeing about a couple of games from Hollenspiel soon that are some of those solo ones. The challenge that I'm going to have, and I'd mentioned this before, my game table at holiday time becomes the gift wrapping table because my office is out away from the house. We can wrap gifts out here without the kids being nosy. So I don't have anywhere to set up anything to play right now. That's a problem. That's a bit of a challenge.
I did purchase something this last weekend.
What'd you get?
Hopefully he'll have it. Iron Curtain from MMP.
I've got that in the stack with it's sitting between Brief Border Wars and Monty's Gamble.
Yep. Ordered it from Fine Games, I think it is. They had it up on Amazon and it shipped USPS. So hopefully this week or very early part of the following week, I'll have it.
So it'll be there by February.
Yeah. Possibly. So I'm in a rural area, and so a lot of our rural mail delivery people are in their own vehicles, right? And I passed this car that had the trunk popped open, It was a mail delivery person, and that trunk was just stuffed full of packages that they were delivering Saturday. You know, so yeah, so Iron Curtain, Brent, you've got this. You know, what piqued my interest was the alternate rule sets, right? It wasn't just the Warsaw Pact attacking NATO. It was, hey, what if NATO decided to make the attack, right?
Yep. What if NATO gets frisky first?
Yeah. You know, I mean, and we don't see that very often.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and the other thing that I really liked about Iron Curtain and what drew me towards it was that using basically the same maps, which we know they're not perfect, but they're pretty close. You can play stuff starting in 48-ish all the way up through about 85. The counters obviously are different. You know, that's why there's like 9 counter sheets and 1 map in there. I'm exaggerating, but not by much. But you've got the ability to explore a variety of different eras and different structures of forces using basically the same rule set and the same map. Just swapping out the counters and swapping out some of the doctrinal organization. That was something that definitely intrigued me and one of the reasons why I wanted to grab Iron. The other thing with Iron Curtain is once my employment status had changed some and I had a little bit of money to spend, I wanted to go support the local game store. And so I made sure to buy, you know, at least once a quarter, once a month, if I can swing it, I go grab something off the rack at the local game store because I've got a great one and I want to keep them going here. And so I go grab something off the rack there. And that was the one I grabbed that time. So for this weekend, being holiday weekend and all, I picked up the new Seven Wonders Architects game because that's something I can get other people in the family to play with me. So I didn't go War Game this past weekend. I went Seven Wonders Architects. But given my love for the Seven Wonders series, that shouldn't be a big surprise. Yeah, but
I think you were mentioning, you know, waiting on or what we've got purchases coming down the pike. I think a lot of us have already made purchases that we're waiting on too. And that's the other thing with me. I've got a lot between GMT and Compass. I don't know how many games I'm still waiting on from, you know, a year ago with the supply chain issues, right? So
yeah.
Well, that's kind of where I'm at, right? Is I have 2 games that I pre-purchased from Compass that should be out this year, and I've got 3 games coming from NWS that I'm awaiting. So,
yeah.
Yeah. At this point, I've got a couple of things on Kickstarter that are going to be due in before too long, but I don't think I've got any pre-orders that I'm waiting to show up or actual orders that I'm waiting to show up at this point. I think everything that's cleared the printer has already arrived here, and I just have a couple of Kickstarters. I jumped on Zermatt from our buddies at Catastrophe Games, and I jumped on another. It was a steampunk looking Euro game thing. It just looked really damn cool, and so I jumped on. I think it was City of the Great Machine. I jumped on that one. But everything else, I don't think I've got anything on pre-order or stuff that I'm waiting to show up now that T2K has arrived. I think I've got it all at this point. So, but hey, audience, for whatever it is that tickles your fancy, go place an order with one of the game companies and let's help keep them around, because more game companies is good, because that's more places for designers to get their games out and more places for us to pick up games to have fun with. And that's kind of what we're after there. So. We're a little over an hour recording this, probably coming a little under an hour by the time I edit out me saying too many times. So let's wrap this one up for the night. BB Mike, any parting thoughts on your war game evolution? Any blinding flashes or realizations you've had about your own gaming timeline as we've been talking about stuff tonight?
I don't think so. Just other than, like I said, it seems to be expanding slowly into new areas, which I think is probably a good thing.
That's good. That's good. That also means you're spending money on new things, right?
Yeah, like I said, I'm trying not to do that, but yeah, I am.
Probably seems to happen some.
It does.
OJ's dad?
My thoughts are right there along with Mike's, just getting new exposure to eras and game systems and enjoying it.
And probably quite a bit of that through your involvement with Saturday Night Fights, huh?
Oh, definitely.
So at what point are we going to get the OJ's Dad franchise expansion to Saturday Night Fights and you're in charge of some games that you're running and streaming and leading?
Oh, I don't know. That's a good question.
Yeah, I'm trying to expand this footprint here. If I can get some of Jim's disciples to break off and start their own branches of the Wargaming Church there, then maybe we can get something going literally every night of the week.
Yeah, well, but The problem, though, with that, Brent, is... Yeah, well, here's the problem, though, right? So I like sitting down there and listening to...
Yeah, the counterclaim
there on Monday nights, right? There just becomes an issue of there's only so many nights a week. I mean, Jim's doing three nights a week right now for the most part.
Yeah.
He's had to cancel this Wednesday due to a conflict. But you know, he's got three nights. You know, you get a fourth night of four or five or a couple of nights watching streams and doing some other stuff. And there's just not a whole lot of time.
Yeah. Well, what that means is we've got to now go out and recruit new participants, right? Audience, you need to come find some games to come join us and play in. So,
Jim's picked up a couple of new players here in the last couple of weeks too. So,
oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's pretty awesome. I think it's great when we can add more players to the family. I'd always love to have, because that's more Wargamers as a whole that are part of the community. So that's great.
Love it when we can. You know, I know BB Mike, I know you do your videos, right? And you post those up and they're good, right? I guess I haven't really looked. What kind of viewership are you getting on those? Do you know?
Are you talking in terms of how many actually people put eyes on these videos?
Yeah.
Because really varies on the subject that, I choose, and I probably average maybe some will average, you know, 80 to 100, some are 500, some are up close to 1,000. It just depends on what I'm running at the time.
Yeah,
it's just all over the place. Honestly, I probably need to go back. I don't really pay too much attention to that stuff.
Oh, no, that's probably, I guess, should. What I was curious about is, are people more likely to watch a live stream where there's multiple people and we're interacting and there's interaction going on in the chat versus...
Oh, I would think yes, without a doubt. I think so.
Yeah.
And I've actually thought about maybe do it live streaming some of these at some point. I think, sure, you're going to get a lot more participation that way.
Yeah.
I've mentioned this to Jim a little bit over the years. I say years, right? It's actually multiple years at this point. But one of the things that I think would be interesting if there was a way to legitimately pull it off for Saturday Night Fights would be, right now it's sort of you're a fly on the wall of somebody else's game room with things happening. But I think it would be interesting for people just tuning in or who are only able to drop in and out of the broadcast rather than sit there and commit 3 hours to watching the whole thing, to have some sort of actual producer on it that has a scroll occasionally running, sort of explaining what's happening, that's doing a little bit of play-by-play or color commentary, almost like they're calling a game from a sporting event. It says, here's kind of what we're looking at. Here's what's going on. Here's the current status of what's happening in the game. Have a little scroll running that says, you know, sort of here's the current victory points, or here's the battle we're doing and what's going on with this battle, you know, in the current status of it all. Almost like when you tune into a football game and you see, okay, it's third quarter, 12 minutes to go. It's 10-7 Eagles, third down and 6 on the 42 or whatever. Like, you get all of that just instantly tuning in. They have some sort of running current information for that. Now, I'm not suggesting that our boy Cyrano take on that job because he's got way too much happening in those shows already. Truthfully, the level of work that I'm describing is a logarithmic jump from the amount of effort that already goes into those shows. But I think it would be interesting for the viewers to see what that does for any kind of engagement or participation or maintaining some relevance in what's happening in the game when you've only got the ability to kind of pop in and out. And I say this as a dude who frequently only has the ability to pop in and out while I'm at work and you guys are gaming. So
it's an interesting question. I jumped over to the Players Aid because they are like the largest, I think, war game site out there that's on YouTube. And if you look at their view, how many views they get on videos, it's in the thousands. And this is not live stuff. This is just talking about games. So I think it depends on what you're talking about and how big your audience is, really.
Yeah.
But I think for sure that the live stuff would be a bigger draw. I think that's absolutely true.
Yep.
But Mike, I think we threw some people your way here this last week on Aardwolf's live stream. So
yeah, somebody mentioned that. And I think I did see a couple of people subscribe. It probably was probably just from that. That was kind of cool.
They were talking about some stuff and somebody mentioned something about Solo, and I think I threw it up there in the chat. Hey, try this one.
There's some Solo stuff there. So I appreciate that.
You know, there's some people came back and like, how did I miss this?
Well, it's easy to miss my channel on this.
Well,
I am yeah. I am no player's aid or anywhere near like even Ardwolf or Mo.
I'm just gonna say, if there's opportunities to throw your name out there when things like that come up, we're, you know, I'm happy to do that. You know,
that's cool.
I know your viewership. Appreciate
that. Yeah, well, you know, and for me, the channel's really more for me and just going through these games and hopefully. You know, what kind of started me doing this was watching some teaching videos that I just thought were horrible. So it's a way for me to learn a game and hopefully teach somebody else how to play a game. And then, you know, talk about the solo aspect of it. But it's cool to get the shout out from somebody like Ardwolf.
Yeah. Well, honestly, I think that's where, you know, Brant, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's where we're really getting the Tuesday news day. To get eyes on that can help too, right?
Yeah. So on Tuesdays, I publish in the bulletin there under the heading of This Week with the Dragoons, everything that we published over the past week goes in there. Plus, links to some of the YouTube videos from some of the other live streams during the week, because like we don't stick the Wednesday night live stream on our front page, but I will always make it a point to call that out in Tuesday Newsday. And so when we get the chance to highlight the stuff that we're doing, look, every video Mike posts for My Own Worst Enemy gets linked to Tuesday Newsday. So folks have the opportunity to find it there. I understand that for some of them, Tuesday Newsday can be a bit of a wall of text and let's go find the specific thing I'm looking for. So I get that sometimes happens, but I'm just trying to be comprehensive and see how much I can share there for folks. But I definitely don't want to shy away from steering people to good content, especially if it's ours. All right, now that we've shilled enough for ourselves here and dragged this broadcast on an extra 10 minutes,
hey, I think we can probably pay us to do.
Exactly. Exactly. So, all right. So at this point, I think we're going to say goodnight to the audience and we'll come back and shill again a little more next week. We've only got another two episodes or so left in this season, depending on the order I bother to release these. We've only got about another two episodes left in this season before we take a break for the holidays and then come back in January. One of the things I do want to make sure folks are aware of is MLK weekend. So January 15, 16, 17, right around there. I don't remember the exact numbers. Somebody look them up and keep me straight. But that will be our January ACDC. And so we were already starting to put the organizing together for some of the bigger events. We are planning on having a pretty robust talk show plan this time. It's not just going to be Gary and Mo where we burn those guys out. We've got a couple of other content creators that are going to be joining us with some designer interviews and some other talk shows. We've got some interesting seminar presentations coming in. We've got some new publishers and new designers that we haven't had at previous ACDCs that are going to be joining us. We are going to add we're trying to sort out the scheduling to be able to add a couple of game events that are not just straight war game things, but like a military themed RPG something, for instance. So we are stretching our boundaries a little bit beyond what we've done in the past. The guys from IKS, the International Kriegsspiel Society, are planning on having at least one big extended game over that weekend. So there's going to be a lot to do at the January ACDC. Make sure you block off that weekend. We're going to go Friday, Saturday, Sunday, like we've done in the past. Monday is the holiday, so you've got Monday to recover. So
January 14, 15, and 16. Mark your calendars.
Thank you for, you know, if only I were sitting in front of some space age device that has access to such information at my fingertips.
It all started with the VIC-20.
Yes. Yes, it did. That's what you're still working on, right?
Yeah. Yes, I am. With my 3K of RAM. Yes.
Yeah, there you go. So that is coming up in January. So start blocking off the calendar now. We are going to get the schedule out as quick as we can before the too much holiday distraction kicks in. But as you can imagine, we will probably still be playing schedule Tetris all the way up to the first week of January. That always seems to happen. We're not going to break tradition. So we appreciate y'all sticking with us through this episode. Guys, thank you both for being here tonight and talking some about your wargaming evolution. And audience, we're going to catch you next time on another episode of Mentioned in Dispatches.